The Osama bin Laden I Know. Chapter 1. Arabia. Osama bin Laden grew up during the 1960s and 1970s in what was then the sleepy city of Jeddah, a port on the Red Sea, which for the past millennia and a half has served as a gateway to the holy city of Mecca, 30 miles away. It was in Jeddah's port that Osama's father, Mohammed bin Laden, would get his start in 1930, working as a porter for pilgrims on their way to Mecca. Bin Laden came of age as the Muslim world was experiencing an Islamic awakening known as the Sawa. This awakening came after Egypt had suffered a devastating defeat in the 1967 war with Israel, so exposing the ideological bankruptcy of Arab nationalism/socialism, which had been the dominant intellectual current in the Middle East since the 1950s. And that defeat came a year after the execution of the Egyptian writer Sayyid Qutb, whose writings and martyrdom would also play a key role in the burgeoning Islamist movement. The period of Islamic awakening would peak in 1979, the first year of a new century on the Muslim calendar, with a series of seismic events that would profoundly influence bin Laden and other future members of al-Qaeda. The overthrow of the Shah of Iran by the cleric Ayatollah Khomeini, the armed takeover of Islam's Holy of Holies, the mosque in Mecca, by Saudi militants, Egypt's historic ceasefire agreement with Israel, and finally, the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. It was a thrilling time to be a deeply committed Muslim, as the 22-year-old bin Laden was. This chapter traces bin Laden's first two decades. It was during this period that bin Laden would first marry, attend university, and start working intensively in the family business. Osama bin Laden, speaking to Jamal Ismail, a correspondent for Al Jazeera Television, in an interview that aired in 1999. God Almighty was gracious enough for me to be born to Muslim parents in the Arabian Peninsula, in Al-Malaz neighborhood in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, on March 10, 1957. Then God was gracious to us as we went to Holy Medina 6 months after I was born. For the rest of my life I stayed in Hejaz, a Saudi province, moving between Mecca, Jeddah, and Medina. As it is well known, my father, Sheikh Mohammed bin Awad bin Laden, was born in Hadramaut in southern Yemen. He went to work in Hejaz at an early age, more than 70 years ago. Then God blessed him and bestowed on him an honor that no other building contractor has known. He built the Holy Mecca Mosque, and at the same time, because of God's blessings to him, he built the Holy Mosque in Medina. Then when he found out that the government of Jordan announced a tender for restoration work on the Dome of the Rock Mosque in Jerusalem, he gathered engineers and asked them, "Calculate only the cost price of the project." When they did, they were surprised that my father, God have mercy on his soul, reduced the cost price in order to guarantee that God's mosques are well served. He was awarded the project. Because of God's graciousness to him, sometimes he prayed in all three mosques, in Mecca, Medina, and Jerusalem, in one single day. May God have mercy on his soul. It is not a secret that he was one of the founders of the infrastructure of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Afterward, I studied in Hejaz. I studied economics at Jeddah University, or the so-called King Abdulaziz University. I worked at an early age on roads in my father's company. May God have mercy on his soul. My father died when I was 10 years old. This is something brief about Osama bin Laden. Brian Fifield Shaler, whose words follow, is a British citizen who lived in Saudi Arabia between 1964 and 1974, where he taught English to a number of the bin Laden boys. The old man bin Laden only had one eye. He was very much a rough laborer-looking kind of person. He could never be smart and elegant. One of the things about Hadramaut in Yemen, it's not a classless society. A lot of it goes on whereabouts in Hadramaut you come from. If you came from Wadi Hadramaut, no one could criticize you because that's where the two ruling dynasties came from. but I suspect the people in Wadi Duan, bin Laden's home valley, were quite low down the pecking order. And of course there is another reason for this, and that is that your occupation depended on which area you came from. Different valleys and different villages supplied laborers, and others supplied jewelers, and others supplied people into import and exports. Other areas supplied cloth merchants. So it was a bit like a medieval market in Western cities, that where you came from influenced the kind of profession you were likely to move into. So there is a pecking order within the Hadramis, and although, of course, they were all aware that they were all one notch down from the top Saudi classes, within them there were infinite gradations. Mohammed bin Laden was from a laboring class, but of course as the bin Ladens made more and more money, they became more and more acceptable. It's a bit like the new money in England. After 20, 30, 50 years, it becomes much more acceptable. The mothers of Mohammed bin Laden's children were very simple women from the villages around the construction camps where he developed. There are a lot of stories about how he acquired some of his very young wives, and they were, I think, primarily chosen, one, because they were Saudi Bedouin, and two, because they were young. That was his interest. All the sons are very good-looking, and they are quite striking. I don't think that I have ever met any ugly bin Ladens. Osama's mother, I am told, she was a great beauty. Since his father never had more than four wives at any one time, he was constantly divorcing the third and the fourth and taking in new ones. I don't know how many different mothers there are. And there's only one more family in Saudi Arabia you can compare that with. This was an anachronism even in the 1950s and 60s, when bin Laden was doing this. The only family that was behaving like this was, in fact, King Abdulaziz and King Saud. I think bin Laden probably even outnumbered King Abdulaziz's children and number of wives. The British are terrible snobs about class, and the Saudis also have their sensitivities, and one of them, in fact, is color, which no Saudi will ever admit to, but of course when anyone gets married in Saudi Arabia, the first question the women ask is, what color? What shade? And there is a great hierarchy, the people who are white, which is beautiful, down to black, which is not beautiful. And so any great brain or terribly able person in Saudi Arabia who tends to be in the darker spectrum tends to be passed over for promotion and other things. Bin Laden is quite fair. I was born in 1942 in Reading, near London. I went to university at Oxford, studied English there, got a degree, and my first job when I graduated in 1963 was in Ghana teaching English. I looked around for more jobs in the teaching world, and so I applied for three jobs, one in Saudi Arabia, one in Libya, and one in Ethiopia. And the Saudi interview was the first to come up. I was interviewed in the embassy in London in the spring, early summer of 64. I arrived in Saudi Arabia about the end of August and was based in Al-Thagr School. The Al-Thagr School was a prestige school, had hundreds of visitors every week. There were presidents of all sorts of countries arriving. Parliamentary delegations from England came. In the secondary school, there were perhaps 20 students in the first class, and I think 16, 17 only in the top third class. So it was, in fact, a very small school. I had a fleet of Jordanians, Egyptians, Syrian, and a Sudanese teacher of English, who were all very good indeed. They were hand-picked from their countries. King Faisal, who became king in 1964, one of the first things he did was to order that all the princes should educate their children in Saudi Arabia. And this was a tremendous upheaval because a number of his brothers and cousins had been in the habit of sending their sons to schools abroad. So, from 1964 onwards, there was a huge influx of young Saudi princes who had been educated in all sorts of ridiculous schools abroad. Some of them couldn't even read and write Arabic, who were brought back forcefully to Saudi Arabia, kicking and screaming in some cases. It became known that it was no longer socially acceptable to send all your children abroad for education, so the top business families had to follow the example of the princes and consider putting their sons in schools in Saudi Arabia. The pupils at Al-Thagr were the elite in all ways. First of all, the sons of the princes and the ministers who were based in Jeddah, and then, of course, there were the top business families. So if you looked along King Abdulaziz Street, which was the main shopping street in those days, and you looked at the names over the shops, many of them second-generation Hadrami businessmen, then those were the names that formed a very big slice of the school, a roll call of the school register. The school has been criticized for being just for the toffs, but in fact it wasn't. My taxi driver's son was at the school. And so it tended to be that the cleverest boys in each class were in fact not from the princely families and not even always from the top business families, but were just extremely bright kids from middle-income or very low-income families. The school didn't owe much to the old Quranic madrasas of Arabia. The headmaster had toured schools in England and picked up some ideas. The curriculum was constantly in a state of development. The school prided itself on its science. I heard no criticism of the curriculum, no criticism at all of the scientific bias of the syllabus while I was there. Remember, the fundamentalists were not known to be a major influence in Saudi society in the 1960s. We had this theatre which we built in the school that was mostly used as an assembly hall for the great and the good of Jeddah, who would come to be addressed by the Crown Prince Faisal, who was chairman of the Board of Governors. It was his school. At the end of my first year in the school, the headmaster said that he was sitting on a committee to form a new university in Jeddah. This was what became King Abdulaziz University. So, in my second year in Saudi Arabia, in 1965, I began to attend these meetings of the founding committee of King Abdulaziz University. By the end of that year, it was decided to have a grand meeting of all the wealthy people in Jeddah, businessmen, bankers, princes, who would pledge money to set up King Abdulaziz University. And so this huge meeting was held inside our school. It was one of many occasions in which Mohammed bin Laden was present. All the businessmen were vying with each other to pledge more of their money. Of course, when the first person pledged 1 million riyals, that was a big event. A huge applause went up in the hall. Bin Laden was in his element there and was thoroughly enjoying himself, outbidding people and upping the ante. So he was a very familiar figure around the school. Now, from an official history of the Saudi Bin Laden Group. The history of Bin Laden began in 1931, when Mohammed Bin Laden founded the company. From its humble beginnings as a general contractor, the company has grown and prospered in parallel with the growth and prosperity of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Over the years, the company has been entrusted with many major construction projects, projects that helped the kingdom to develop its resources and expand its infrastructure. Under the leadership of the late M. Bin Laden, the company diversified into other areas and became an international conglomerate with interests ranging from its traditional construction business to industrial and power projects, petroleum, chemicals and mining, telecommunications, operations and maintenance, manufacturing and trading. The preceding was once published on the Internet, disappearing after the 9/11 attacks. The 1967 Six-Day War that Israel fought against Egypt, Syria, and Jordan when bin Laden was 10 had a profound impact on the Arab world. The Egyptian government had promised a quick victory against Israel. Instead, it was a spectacular defeat that called into question the very basis of Egyptian President Gamal Nasser's regime, which was built on secular Arab nationalism and socialism. The defeat would energize the Islamist movement around the Arab world. Essam Deraz, an Egyptian army officer who would spend more than a year with bin Laden on the front lines in Afghanistan during the 1980s, recalls what the 67 defeat meant to him and his fellow Islamists. "I can tell you what the War of 67 did to the region. I was a reconnaissance officer, so I was moving in front of troops. So I saw this whole war as a movie. The Egyptian officers and soldiers saw their colleagues burned by napalm. We saw the army of our country destroyed in hours. We thought that we would conquer Israel in hours. I discovered that it wasn't Israel that defeated us, but it was the Egyptian regime that defeated us. And I started to be against the regime. It wasn't a military defeat, it became a civilizational defeat. We didn't know that we were so backward. We were so retarded, so behind the rest of the modern civilization. There was an earthquake in the Arab Islamic personality, not only in Egypt, but in the entire Arab world. Brian Fifield Shaler. The 1967 war between Israel and Egypt had a big effect on the school. Many of the children wanted to get on buses to go and join the good cause, but the school made an effort to keep them in the classrooms and told them the best way to fight their cause was to get a good education. Hatifa Azam is the son of bin Laden's mentor, the Palestinian cleric Abdullah Azam, who took up arms against the Israelis during the 1967 war. These are his words. "When the Jews took the area of Jenin in Palestine, and my father's village, Selah al-Hathai, my father took some of his friends, followers, and relatives, and they took their guns, and they were trying to make resistance against this. At the time, he was 26, teaching in a high school. So my father tried to make a movement of local resistance. They decided to transfer to Jordan and to restart their mission from Jordan. He made training camps known as the Camps of the Real Muslim Religious People on the border of Palestine. They continued their movement until 1970. My father wrote a special book. It's called Palestine from Heart to Heart. You could say the title means we don't want to lose Palestine forever." Next, Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer, speaks. "Bin Laden said that his father was not a very well-educated man, and that's why, following the 1967 war, he called all the engineers of his bin Laden construction company and he asked them how many bulldozers we have. So they counted the bulldozers and they said that we have more than 250 bulldozers. So Mohammed bin Laden asked the engineers, 'Can you convert these bulldozers into 250 tanks?' So one engineer asked, 'Why?' Bin Laden's father said, 'I want to use these tanks against the Jews because they have captured our land.' Bin Laden's father was very, very, very anti-Israel, anti-Jewish, because he was of the view that the land of Palestine belongs to the Arabs. You can understand his love for Al-Quds, the Arabic name for Jerusalem, through an example told to me by Osama bin Laden. He said that that was a routine of his father once or twice in a month. He used to offer his morning prayers in Medina, afternoon prayers in Mecca, and then the evening prayers in Jerusalem, because he had a plane." Brian Fifield Shaler recalls teaching a young Osama bin Laden English in the year after the death of his father, Mohammed bin Laden. "This was my fourth year teaching when Osama came along in 1968, when he was aged 11. Osama was one of 30 students. He used to sit two-thirds of the way back on the window side that looked out onto sports fields and playing grounds. Why did I remember Osama? First of all, I would have noticed because of his name, because of the family, and of course, when you walked into a class of anyone of his age, he was literally outstanding because he was taller than his contemporaries, and so he was very noticeable. His English was not amazing. He was not one of the great brains of that class. On the other hand, he was not in the bottom. But this does not necessarily mean that he is middling, because it was one of the top two schools in the country. So to be in the middle of the top class at the top school really puts you in the top 50 students in the country. So although he did not shine at that particular school, nationally he would be one of the top 50 students of his age, education-wise. It's most important to put this particular student in context. He did not start as a monster, something I have subsequently been very interested in. How much can you tell of a person's personality from how they were at 11? Sometimes I have thought that people don't change, that these things are formed very early in life. On the other hand, how much of the man can you tell from an 11 or 12-year-old? He was extraordinarily courteous. But this, of course, is also a characteristic of students in Saudi Arabia in general. But I think he was, in fact, more courteous than the average student, probably partly because he was a bit shyer than most of the other students. For example, when the teacher asked questions, a forest of hands would go up, "Ask me, ask me." And Osama would not do that. It's one of the things I do remember about him. He would sit quietly, with a very confident smile on his face. But he would not push forward to display his knowledge. And of course, if you actually asked him, then he was usually right, but he didn't push himself forward. He wasn't one of the students who sat in the front row and demanded the teacher's attention, and nor was he one of those who slunk away in the back row. And so he was not pushy in any way. It was big news, it was national news, when Mohammed, Osama's father, was killed in a plane crash in 1967. I remember getting the news. I was in Taif when I got the news, and of course Mohammed bin Laden built the road to Taif, the so-called Christian Road, which in fact was a military road from Jeddah bypassing Mecca to Taif. The news came through that Mohammed bin Laden had been killed. And of course, everyone was very shocked. Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer. Osama told me that when his father died, Saudi King Faisal wept for many days, so they were close. Brian Fifield Shaler. And for the next year at least, the future of the bin Laden business hung in the balance. There were a lot of projects that were not completed, and it was the major construction company of Saudi Arabia. So it was of huge importance, so there was a great deal of anxiety for the finances and for the running of the company. And there was probably only Salem, Osama's eldest brother, and three or four brothers at that period who were of an age even to take on the mantle. Salem was educated at Millfield boarding school in England. Salem was a fraction younger than me, but not much. I was introduced to him by mutual friends. Nothing at all to do with the school or his much younger brothers who were in the school, just on a social level. Most of my contacts with Salem would have been in 73-74. He was very westernized. His English was beautiful. It was very fluent, very characterful. He played the guitar, he had lots of Western friends, and was a great socialite in Jeddah. And from a relative of the bin Laden family who knew Salem was a unique individual by any standard. By Saudi standards, he was off the charts. Very charismatic, amusing, no facial hair. He played guitar, 60s hits like Where Have All the Flowers Gone? He acted as sort of a court jester to King Fahd and was part of Fahd's inner circle. Sometime he overstepped with the king. One time he buzzed the king's camp in the desert with one of his planes, which went down badly, but he was always taken back into the fold. Salem took control of the business beginning in 73-74. The links to the royal family that his father had cultivated had subsided by then. Salem was very successful at rekindling that relationship. If King Fahd wanted a palace built, Salem would build it for him. He was born in 1946, and so was 21 when his father died in 1967. King Faisal, the most respected of all the Saudi monarchs, arranged for the bin Laden company to be put into trust until the children were older. Salem was personally responsible for distributing the dividends. Some brothers, such as Ali, who lives in Paris, cashed out of the business. This raises the question of how much money bin Laden inherited from his family. Certainly far less than the figures of $200 to $300 million mentioned in the media after 9/11. In fact, according to someone designated by the family to speak to me, bin Laden benefited from the distribution of his father's estate according to Sharia law, which meant that sons received twice as much as daughters. However, with 54 children, even Mohammed bin Laden's vast fortune did not go too far. Until bin Laden's family cut him off in 1994, over the course of the two decades or so that he benefited from the distribution of his father's estate, he would have received something like $20 million. In the years following his father's death, Salem visited Sweden to establish business relationships for the family firm and to purchase a fleet of trucks from Volvo. During this period, Salem got to know the small town of Falun, famed for its iron mine, and a local nightclub, Ophelia. Christina Åkerblad is the former owner of the Hotel Astoria in Falun. Here, she recalls that in 1970, the 23-year-old Salem bin Laden and his 13-year-old brother, Osama, came to visit. The Hotel Astoria was just a small bed and breakfast hotel. They, Salem and Osama, just came to sleep with us and to have breakfast. On the other side of the street there was a very huge hotel, and they took food from this hotel, and they took the food up to their rooms and sat in Astoria to have their dinner. They didn't want to eat at the bigger hotel. I don't know why, but they did so. We had this hotel in 1970 and 1971, and they came to us both years. The two of them came in the first year, Osama bin Laden and his elder brother Salem. What I remember very well is that they came with a big Rolls Royce, and it was forbidden to park the car outside the building in this street. But they did it, and we, my husband and I, said to them, "You have to pay a fine for every day and every hour you are staying outside this hotel." But they said, "Oh, it doesn't matter. It's so funny to go to the police station and to talk with the police. We will stay where we are." It was like a joke to them. They had so much money, they didn't know how much money they had. They came with their own flight to Copenhagen because I asked them how they had managed to come to Sweden with this enormous Rolls Royce. They said, "We have our plane, and the plane is staying in Copenhagen, and then we have driven through Sweden because we want to make contacts in Sweden." I asked them what sort of contacts, but they didn't answer my question. They stayed 1 week. It was in the winter of 1970. I think it was in January. There was a lot of snow outside the street. It was a very cold winter this year. They came like two very elegant boys. They were dressed very exclusive. They were very nice, and they had very lovely eyes, I remember, especially Osama. His eyes, it was streaming love from his eyes. My two sons, Anders and Jörg, admired them because they were so nicely dressed, and they had curly black hair, and they were very friendly. When they saw our boys in the corridor, they said hello to them, and they played a little bit with them. They had two double rooms. They slept in one bed, and on the other bed they had their bags. On the Sunday I had no cleaner at the hotel, so I took care of the room myself, and I was shocked because in the big bag they had lots of white, expensive shirts from Christian Dior and Yves Saint Laurent. When they had used the shirt once, they dropped it. So the cleaner had taken these shirts to wash them, but they said to her, "No, we are just using them once, so you can take them if you want." In the smaller bag they had lots of jewels for shirts, very exclusive diamonds and rubies and emeralds and so on. It was fantastic to see. Salem and Osama said that they were about 60 children altogether. When they said goodbye to us, they said, "Next year we will see you again, and I hope we will take the whole family with us. We will get in touch with you when we are coming." The year after, they came again. I think there were 23 children on the second visit. That following year, Hans Lindqvist, a reporter for Falun's newspaper, the Dalarnes Tidningar, was asked to do a feature piece on a large family visiting from Saudi Arabia. An excerpt of his story from September 7, 1971, follows. Arab Celebrity Visit. Yesterday, Salem bin Laden visited Falun on a combined business and pleasure trip through Europe. He was accompanied by 22 members of his family, which in total consists of 54 children. The young sheikh, who is 26 years old, arrived in his private jet to Borlänge Airport, while the rest of the family arrived by car. He has visited the Club Ophelia in Falun. The young sheikh is reportedly a big fan of discos and has visited the discos of Falun at various times in the past, however, not together with his family. The sheikh is said to be the owner of a big and successful construction company in his home country, Saudi Arabia. In Gothenburg, it is said that he surprised Volvo by entering their office, ordering a large number of trucks for his company. The family is now traveling to Stockholm, where they will visit Nitro Nobel AB. The sheikh's private jet has been sent to London.